consent.
Of course, we're going to see what happens. All new technology brings benefits and dangers.
And the computers will be seeing what happens, too. Thanks to the talent who have to face us each week to produce the show, Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also thanks to financial support from Rena Scholsky David and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, where scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to No Face to Hide. If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science, you'll find those episodes in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio, because otherwise you'll have to face your handheld device, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, well, consider letting them know you like the show.
Oh, and do you have a comment, a criticism, or a suggestion? Well, throw in some faint praise and then email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
And a shade taller. And can you replace the thinning hair with buoyant, thick curls? I think that would suit me better.
Yes, monsieur.
This is Aaron from Under Oath, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 FM on your dial, and WHFR.FM online.
1985, 1986.
WHFR has been on the air for 30 years. During that time, WHFR has had hundreds of staff members. Were you one of those past members of WHFR? What year were you a part of the station?
1992.
Whatever the year was, we're calling out on you, the alumni of WHFR Radio. Join us to celebrate WHFR's 30th year on the air.
1997.
On Saturday, October 3rd, we are having an alumni reunion party.
2000.
WHFR will be holding an open house and reception at the Pavilion of HFC's Student Center and Culinary Arts Building. There will be tours of the radio station and a dinner in the pavilion area. If you're interested in attending or need more information on the event, please email WHFR's operations manager, Lara Rassay, at whfr@hfcc.edu. Or you could give her a call at 313-317-6539. The WHFR Alumni Reunion Party.
2012.
So many years, so many memories. Come share them with us at HFC's Student Center on October 3rd.
2015.
WHFR, 30 years on the air, and we are just getting started.
On October 2nd, we'll be celebrating the 5th College Radio Day.
College radio plays an immense role in discovering new music.
It's our job to shine a light on the artists that deserve it.
When we play a song on college radio, you hear the passion of the air talent or the DJ.
No! Supporting the unsigned, the local, and the independent, hundreds of college radio stations across the country will unite to celebrate the unique medium of college radio.
Personally, I feel like I'm impacting the music scene.
College radio plays a huge role in discovery of these smaller bands, these bands that might be going on even in your backyard, but you don't even know about them because they're not getting played on major stations yet.
On October 2nd, join us for an event like no other. For more information, please visit collegeradioday.com. College radio, it's your authentic guide to the next generation of music.
This is the city where danger lurks. Today, a new creature walks among us, causing fear, mayhem, and injury.
Stay back, children.
Mommy, I'm scared.
Look out for the dreaded digital deadwalkers. They're not looking out for you. With faces pressed against their little handheld devices, they put all good citizens in harm's way.
Hey, pal.
Pardon you.
The digital deadwalkers are multiplying. Until their behavior patterns can be modified, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons warns all innocent people to stay alert. Better yet, to step up and speak out.
Hey, dude, I'm walking here.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
A public service message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, who want to keep everyone well connected with healthy bones.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
Love to design stuff and play on the internet? Henry Ford College offers a one-year certificate program in Web Technologies and Design. Advanced HTML, computer art, web authoring tools, and web multimedia are a few of the courses offered.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
The program is designed to prepare a student to take CIW Certificate Internet Webmaster exams.
For more information on CIW exams, log on to www.ciwcertified.com.
Drop by the HFC Counseling Office or log on to the web at hfcc.edu.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
The following is an encore presentation of Sierra Club Radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Ben Montgomery about his new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk. We'll also speak with Henry Nichols, who is an expert on the Galapagos, about his book called The Galapagos. And Avital Andrews from Sierra Magazine will share some green tips for a green 4th of July. Joining us now is Ben Montgomery. He's here to talk with us about his book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Ben, we're glad to have you on the show. And, of course, our listeners at Sierra Club Radio are very interested in the Appalachian Trail. And your book is about an interesting piece of history related to the trail. And I'm wondering if you could start just by telling us how you came to the story and how you decided to work on this book project.
I grew up hearing stories from my mother about Emma Gatewood, these fascinating tales of an old woman on a wild adventure. I remember my mom telling me about her scaring off a black bear somewhere in the Northwest and being mistaken for a hobo passing through a town somewhere along the Oregon Trail. And I was always fascinated by her story, knowing that she had she had solo through hiked the AT three times, the first woman to do so, and she had also hiked the Oregon Trail. I always was struck by this kind of primary question: why did she do this? Why did she start walking at late in life, at the age of 67? So I'm a newspaper journalist, and I did a story that got a lot of attention a couple of years ago and wound up with an agent in New York who wrote to say, hey, I wonder if you have any book ideas. And a couple surfaced, and this was the one that everybody seemed to really like. So off to the races we went.
So tell us about her story. How did she start? What made her start walking at the age of 67? And what were some of the adventures that she had along the way?
Yeah, so in 1955, she told her family that she was going on a walk and didn't fill in the details. She had, at that point, she was 67. She had 11 children, 23 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. And for all intents and purposes, she disappeared. She left her hometown of Gallipolis, Ohio, in southeastern Ohio, and nobody heard from her for about 9 weeks. And when they did finally hear from her, she had dropped a postcard in the mail back home from Roanoke, Virginia. And she explained, when I said I was going on a walk, I meant I'm trying to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail. And she had hiked at that point from Mount Oglethorpe in Georgia, which at the time was the southern terminus, all the way to Roanoke, Virginia. She had quite an adventure. First of all, she was completely unprepared for a through hike. You know, today we buy top-flight backpacks and the best, lightest sleeping bags and the best hiking boots. And she struck out in KED tennis shoes. She had a handmade drawstring denim sack that she slung over her shoulder. She didn't have a sleeping bag. She had an army blanket and a shower curtain to keep her dry when it was rainy. She had a tin of Band-Aids and bobby pins and some Vicks salve and some bouillon cubes to suck on for salt. No real provisions, you know, no dry-freezed fruit or anything like that. She relied primarily on her own instincts in terms of getting food on the trail. She ate wild strawberries and blueberries and nuts and sorrel salad. It's a grass that grows along the trail. And relied often on the kindness of strangers. She would approach homes when she was hungry or in need of a bed. She would approach somebody's house along the trail and just knock and introduce herself and tell folks what she was doing and kind of invite herself to dinner.
This is such a fascinating story. What prompted her to set off on a journey like this?
That's the question I explore in the book, and it's hard to say. First of all, she never drove a car, so she did a lot of walking throughout her life. If she was going to visit a friend 10 miles away, she went on foot. So walking wasn't unique for her, but she had read about the trail in 1949 in a copy of National Geographic magazine. It was a big, full-color, 9-page spread that painted the trail, which was very little known at this point. Only a handful of men had thru-hiked the trail. But she read that one of a moderate physical well-being could, quote, hayfoot strawfoot from Georgia to Maine. She read that the trail was as wide as a Mack truck and that there were sleeping facilities within a day's walk and there was plenty of food. And she started fantasizing about walking it. She didn't tell any of her children of her plan for fear they'd try to stop her. But she began to prepare quietly, save up her money and to take a small, short adventures into the woods to sleep overnight and figure out what she would need to get by. But as she started to get attention, which was about Roanoke, Virginia, boy, newspaper reporters came out of the woodwork and everybody wanted to know what she was doing out on the trail. And she told them all, surprisingly, something different. Often she said, I'm doing it on a lark. She said, I didn't have anything better to do. She said, I wanted to see what's over the hill and then what's over the one beyond that. And what I came to uncover interviewing four of her surviving children and reading through her diaries and her journals was that for 30 years, she was married to an abusive, oppressive man who, on a number of occasions, beat her within an inch of her life. And when she finally got the kids grown, they had one last fight where he broke her ribs and bloodied her nose and blacked her eyes, and she wound up in jail. He convinced the justice of the peace to arrest her because she was crazy. The mayor of this small town where they lived in West Virginia, he realized that she was a battered spouse and bailed her out. And she filed for divorce. And for the first time in her life, she didn't have to do what her husband wanted her to do. And she found this level of independence that she made the most of.
Wow, that's an incredible story. I'm curious if you can tell us more about the effect that this had on the trail and on the history of the trail. What kind of impact did her story have on other people and on the development of this landmark that's become so important in American history?
It was never the idea of the fathers of the AT, the planners, the folks who started bringing it together in the 20s and 30s. It was never their idea that this would be something someone would walk in one continuous stretch. In fact, there's evidence to suggest they thought that would be impossible to go on foot from Georgia to Maine. So it was relatively little known until around 1948 when a man named Earl Schaefer, who was walking off his demons from World War II, struck out and hiked the trail in one season and sent a letter to the Appalachian Trail Conservancy saying, I've done basically the first through hike. And they doubted him at first until he showed them pictures and showed them his journal entries. And so, Earl got a little attention, but not a whole lot, a couple of newspaper stories. The second person to through hike, same thing. It was sort of overlooked. He got a story in his hometown newspaper in Macon, Georgia, and outside of that, there's not much. So when Grandma Gatewood, I think just because she was who she was, 67-year-old woman, when she started on the trail, when she hit Roanoke, Virginia, and that first newspaper story ran, I think it just captured the attention of a nation who was looking for a little distraction and a good news story and the throes of the Cold War and in the wake of some racial violence in the South after Brown versus Board of Education the year before. And so every town she walked through just about north of Roanoke, she'd run into a newspaper reporter who was there wanting to share her story. And by the end of her first journey in 55, her travels were being documented daily by the Associated Press and by the United Press. And there was a feature story on her in Sports Illustrated, several thousand words. Later on, she appeared on the You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx. She was on the Dave Garraway Show, on the Today Show. She did a ton of radio and was in newspapers across the country. And I think the American public, they were rooting for her. You know, this woman has struck out and is doing this. Really is like an incredible physical feat at her age. And so, she was something of a hero, almost the last sort of celebrity pedestrian, if you will.
How is she memorialized today?
She has one of the most beautiful stretches of trails I've ever seen in Hocking Hills State Park in Ohio, her home state, is named after her, the Grandma Gatewood Trail. And it is just a beautiful, beautiful place. She thought it was the most interesting geology she'd ever seen. It's in a sort of a long canyon with a bunch of caves and caverns and waterfalls. So that trail is named after her. There's, she was inducted. She was a lifetime member of the National Campers and Hikers Association. She is in the Appalachian Trail Hall of Fame. She was one of five in the second class of hikers to be inducted into the AT Hall of Fame in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. And outside of that, I think, she is motivation for even modern through hikers. I climbed Mount Katahdin in September of 2012 to try to sort of retrace her steps up the mountain on that inaugural through hike, and we just reached Baxter's Peak at the same time about 30 hikers were finishing through hikes, and I let them enjoy the moment a little bit, and then sheepishly approached them, and I wanted to ask, if they knew of Grandma Gatewood's story, and if they did, what did they think of it? And by and large, everybody in that group knew of Grandma Gatewood at the very least, and many of them had, their own experiences where she had served as motivation when times got tough. So I think she that's probably her legacy, that she fuels modern hikers in many ways. If Grandma Gatewood could do it, I can do it.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Ben Montgomery talking about his new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk. And for more information about the book, you can visit chicagoreviewpress.com. Henry Nichols joins us today to talk with us about his book, The Galapagos. A science writer and the editor of Galapagos Matters, the biannual magazine of the Galapagos Conservancy, Henry Nichols is well-versed in both the history of the area and the most recent debates surrounding its conservation. He's here to talk with us about it today. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm curious to hear about how you first got interested in this part of the world. What drew you to the Galapagos region?
I studied evolutionary biology. And then when you do that, and Darwin is this kind of key figure, the Galapagos feels like a place you've got to go to. So that was what led me there. But that was about 10 years ago I first went.
And what were your experiences like visiting the islands? I mean, what really drew you to make this a big part of your life's work?
So I went there on holiday that first time, and I met the very famous giant tortoise, Lonesome George, as everybody who visits does, or did, I should say, because he sadly died two years ago. And he sort of struck me as this amazing subject for a book, and he was the subject of my first book. So I used him, his story, his tragic story. He was the last individual of his kind And he was in that very rare situation for 40 years, so for the whole of my lifetime. And so I told his story and explored extinction and conservation, and the Galapagos was a big part of that. But here I wanted to actually get to know the archipelago better. So islands themselves are the kind of subject of this almost biographical account.
Tell us about your perspective on why the Galapagos matters to all of us, no matter where we live. I mean, for folks who haven't been there, might never be there, why is it a place that you think people should care about?
Yes, there are lots of reasons, and it's sort of a nested argument, really. It obviously matters to the people that live there, and that in itself is enough reason alone. But there are 30,000 people that live there, and not everybody appreciates that. And even beyond them, it's of tremendous importance to Ecuador, which owns the Galapagos. So it's a very significant economic draw, a touristic draw, and so the huge amount of revenue that Ecuador generates at the national level. So for Ecuador, it quite clearly matters. Not just for its economic value, of course, through its global significance, but that really is why it matters to everybody else, because everybody wants to go to the Galapagos, and it's for that iconic, really relatively untouched reason. It stands out now because we've trashed so much of the world of the Galapagos, as damaged as it might be, and it is a bit, is still remarkably special, and anyone that has visited there will recognize that. You just go there and you are suddenly in a very, very different place with respect to the other animals and plants with which we share the planet. So the intimacy you can have with nature in the Galapagos is quite an unsettling, not in a bad way, but very destabilizing. Just really gives you a radically different perspective on the world and your position in it. And so it's very, very remarkable for that.
What are some of the unusual plants and wildlife that people would see if they went to travel there?
Yes, it is kind of reason people go, but it's strange because there's actually not that much there. What is there, though, is very odd and unique. So about almost half of all species there are unique to the Galapagos. They were made in Galapagos. And so it is this site of the origin of species. It's where stuff gets created. And, of course, the giant tortoises are the most famous, and the animals that gave the islands their name, the Galapagos, it translates as the tortoises, or Islas de las Galapagos, is the islands of the tortoises. And so they're incredibly striking, these huge, almost antediluvian creatures lumbering across this volcanic landscape. More startling, perhaps, at least to me, are these marine iguanas that lie along the shores of all these islands. And they're not very large. They're maybe 1 or 2 foot long, or up to 10 kilograms in the most extreme cases. But they are extraordinary because this is the only lizard iguana that goes foraging into the sea. It goes diving down. So this is a species that rocked up there, we think, you know, as the islands were forming, and then had to survive. And there's very little vegetation, and the sort of succulent vegetation on which these iguanas would have to depend just wasn't there. So they started eating algae, and so they go down diving for this. And they have various amazing adaptations to be able to do that, and amongst the most obvious one, being able to swim and dive and hold your breath and stay underwater and survive for, you know, up to an hour if they need to. They don't usually do that. So those are the most striking things. But then, of course, very, very famous are the finches, which have become this kind of paradigm of evolutionary biology. So we have 14 different species of finch there. They're not very striking to look at. They're a little bit dull, but they are very important as tools really for teaching evolutionary biology, but these beaks differ very markedly between the different species. And we can, and have, and scientists have been doing this, monitor within the space of weeks, months. If you get a large amount of death within a population, as happens regularly, the average beak size of a species will shift measurably. I mean, if humans can measure it over the space of 1 or 2 weeks, you know, we're talking a millimeter shift in the size of a beak. And so we can see evolution happening in this group, so it's very remarkable for that. And then there's a whole bunch of other wonderful things, notably the blue-footed boobies and several other two other species of booby, and lots of other great seabirds that you'll see there.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the ethical considerations for people who are considering traveling to the Galapagos. What are some of your thoughts on that? How can we have people explore the area without also destroying it?
I think that the most important thing is to really think about just that question before you go. And that means reading, not necessarily my book, but it's not a bad starting place, but there's lots of things to read up. And really take that decision responsibly. I mean, it's a big decision to fly anywhere at all these days, and that's a major one. If you can square that, and you might be able to, then visiting the islands, there are lots of different ways in which to visit the island, and the main distinction, I think, is whether you do a land-based, hotel-based tour, and you can just go to the Galapagos and stay in a hotel the whole time, or you get on a boat, which is much more expensive. So you could go and see the Galapagos. My feeling is that if you went on a hotel-based tour, you wouldn't see what is so special about the Galapagos, and that is the different islands and the subtle but very, very important differences between the islands. So the sorts of things that Charles Darwin came to appreciate after his 5-week visit there. I think that's really important, because it is in that we see or start to appreciate how novelty is created and new species arise. And it is that the Galapagos is really most special for. So there's lots to think about, and I think people need to shop around and ask around and ask where their money, it's a lot of money to go, where their money is going to go and how it is going to do the most good. And I think if you've thought through some of those things, then you're in a good place, really. But largely, the tours are incredibly wonderfully run, and the natural history guides are amazingly highly qualified. I would say that choosing a highly qualified guide is very important. They come at 3 different levels, so you could really get a very different quality of experience depending on the level of guide you choose. And it is very much worth paying more to get the top quality guide. You will just have a completely different experience.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Henry Nichols, author of a new book, The Galapagos.
Joining us now in our studio is Avi Taub, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Orly.
So today we're going to talk about how to green your 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
How can you do a green, let's start with barbecue. How do you do a green barbecue?
There are a few things you can do. One is consider your coal. And anyone affiliated with the Sierra Club knows how we feel about coal. So what you can do, if you're looking for a grill, if you don't already have one, you can choose an electric or a propane-powered grill or a solar oven over a cooker that burns through charcoal. And granted, those aren't amazing either, but they are cleaner burning.
Okay, so that is one better option.
Yeah, those are a couple.
If you're going to use briquettes, are there kinds that you can use that have less of an impact?
There is, yes. So if you've only got a coal-fired grill and you don't want to trash it quite yet to replace it with a cleaner one, you can choose briquettes that are made of things like invasive tree species or from sustainably managed forests. And if that sounds kind of opaque and you're not sure how to find those, if you're looking for the FSC logo or the Rainforest Alliance logo, you'll do well when you're choosing your coal or your charcoal.
Great. So if people have their grill all set up, and hopefully they're choosing one of these greener options, the next choice is food. So what do you consider green food choices for a barbecue?
Considering that UN report that came out that says that raising livestock for food creates more pollution than all modes of transportation combined, this is definitely something to take into account. And that fact would naturally lead you toward vegetarian recipes. And there are really some great vegetarian grilling recipes. People kind of shy away from them because it's the 4th of July. But if you just Google vegetarian grilling recipes, you will find thousands. And a lot of them are really hearty and satisfying.
And, you know, we've done a couple really great interviews over the years with different cooks and chefs on this topic. And I know that there are people out there who say, you know, it's the 4th of July, I need to have some meat. I mean, that to them is really part of the holiday. But when we had Mark Bittman on the show a while ago, one of the things he pointed out as a chef is that, you know, you can still cut back on meat usage even if you don't want to be a vegetarian. Reducing the amount of meat that you eat is also a way that you can contribute.
Absolutely. And yeah, we definitely don't want to be extremist about this when we talk to people about eating less meat. That doesn't mean you have to be a complete vegetarian. You can just eat maybe, you know, half a hot dog or and then just supplement those calories with salad or corn or something else. But if you're eating, you can still have your token meat item and still have that 4th of July feeling. But yes, eat less meat.
Well, of course, it's very similar to driving a car. I mean, the best thing to do is to give up your car entirely and ride a bike. But for people who can't do that,
exactly,
cutting back on the car usage.
Exactly. If we're looking at realistic options for some people.
Now, let's talk about things like cutlery and flatware.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the times when people go to the 4th of July barbecue, if you're trying to be green, you feel guilty about throwing out all the disposable stuff. So what do you do about that?
So yeah, this is going to depend on your situation, whether you're out at a public park having a picnic or doing something in your backyard. If it's at home, you really don't need to go out and get those disposable plastic things unless you're going to wash them and reuse them. But it's just, you know, it's always best to use your reusable stuff that you've got at home. But if you've got to go throw away, then get the biodegradable stuff, get something that can be recycled or composted. And the same goes with napkins. You know, if you've got cloth napkins at home, bring them along and just throw them in the laundry after instead of throwing them away after. If you've got paper napkins, put them in the compost. Just sort of be smart about your situation and what you've got to do.
Well, those are some great 4th of July tips for greening your barbecue event. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Avital, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Want to know what's happening in the indie music scene in Detroit? Well, of course you do! This is Steve Homer. Join me every Wednesday for the latest indie music news, a new release schedule, plus bands coming to town as we play the songs that go with it. Plus, I sample some of the best new indie releases on the Spotlight release feature. So, get the latest indie intel on the indie music scene on Culture City Radio, Wednesday from noon to 2 on WHFR 89.3 FM, the only station making waves, and on WHFR.FM.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Kotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Audrey Peterman, the author of a book called Our True Nature, Finding a Zest for Life in the National Park System. We'll also speak with Janet Larson from the Earth Policy Institute, who is co-author of a book called The Great Energy Transition. And Marianne Hitt from the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign will talk with us about some interesting new developments on their campaign. Joining us now is Audrey Peterman, the author of Our True Nature, Finding a Zest for Life in the National Park System. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Orly. A pleasure to be here with you. I'm so thankful that you have me on.
And we're so glad to have you back on the show. I know we talked with you previously a while back about some of your experiences visiting the national parks. And we're just really interested in hearing from you about, you know, why you decided to write this book and what you were hoping to accomplish with it.
Yes. Well, I pour out my overwhelming love for the national park system in America in this book. And the fact that having visited 170 units from Alaska to Florida, I feel like I have a total grip on the American experience and what it means to be American, even though I am an immigrant to this country. And I wanted to share that the beauty I've seen, the history I've discovered, and the sense of belonging that the parks give me, and that's why I wrote this book.
Now, what prompted in the beginning this quest to go visit so many of our national parks? What first made you fall in love with the national park system?
Well, you know, it's a funny story because my husband Frank and I, and Frank is American, and with our last child having graduated from college, we were thinking of moving to Belize in Central America because we discovered that they have such a love for their environment and think the land is the best thing they have to pass on to their successors. So while we were there scouting out the place, Frank was having a drink with a Belizean man in a bar, and the gentleman asked him about the Badlands, and then he asked him about the Grand Canyon. And Frank had to say, I've never been to either of those places. And that's when we realized that we really could not leave our country because we did not know America. And so when we came back, we decided to take a couple of months off and just drive around the entire country from Florida to Washington State and stop at the Badlands in particular and the Grand Canyon in particular. And at that time, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a national park system. I thought that these were just incredibly beautiful places that we were visiting. It was actually when we got to Yellowstone and I kept seeing the sign National Park behind Acadia, Acadia National Park, Badlands National Park, Mount Rushmore National Park, Yellowstone National Park, that I said, well, what the heck is a national park? And when I found out, I was so astonished and amazed. And in our travels, we realized that we didn't see any other black people or any Hispanic people or any Native Americans in these places. And we thought, we've got to do something about that.
And so what is your book, what does your book attempt to do? And how do you also, in the book, share some of the contributions that African Americans have made to our national parks? Because there have been so many over the years that people might not know about.
Exactly. Well, that's the best thing. Besides sharing the beauty and the enormous grandeur of places such as Denali National Park and Mount Denali in Alaska, I talk about the Boston National Historical Park, for example, which also includes the place where the Revolutionary War started and where the first patriot shot dead was a black man named Crispus Attucks. I share the fact that off the coast of Florida and the Dry Tortugas National Park, that was where Dr. Mudd, who was implicated in the shooting of President Lincoln, that's where he was incarcerated. But more importantly, that huge fort that at one time was the largest brick structure in the Western Hemisphere and is part of America's defense was actually built with the labor of enslaved Africans. So I show all these places in the country that have the history of black people, of Hispanic people, of Asians, and the people who are generally left out of history.
I know that African American soldiers were among the first people to guard Yosemite National Park as well. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and also Sequoia National Park. In fact, we're trying now to get a Buffalo Soldiers Trail established in Sequoia National Park because in 1903, before the Park Service, the agency that now manages the national park system, before the Park Service was formed, the Army was the one in charge of managing the national parks, and they sent the Buffalo Soldiers riding up to the Sierra Nevada mountains in 1903 to build a road into the giant forest of sequoias. And that would enable, you know, wealthy tourists and visitors to come and add their voices to the need for protection of these spectacular places. And I can tell you that when I am in Giant Grove in Sequoia, the feeling of being among these 2,000-year-old giants is so overpowering that I literally feel as if I am in the presence and the company of God. And so it's just a glorious thing to be a fan of the national park system.
And so how many did you say you've been to altogether?
170, and next weekend I'm going to a new one. I'm going to go to Devil's Tower, so I'll be up to 171.
And how many are there total in the system?
There are about 410. And of course, these include not just the large-scale ecosystem parks like Grand Canyon, etc., but also the national monuments and the historic sites, etc.
Right, because the ones that are the large-scale national parks, I believe there are 60 of them,
60,
is that right?
Yes, mm-hmm. 60.
And have you been to all 60 of those?
No, I've only been to 35.
So which of all the ones you've been to, which have been your favorites? I know that you probably can't say, you can't pick a favorite, you know, it's like picking a favorite child, but I'm sure you've had some where the experience has been truly dramatic for you.
What I have to tell you, the Grand Teton National Park, where the greatest vista is the Grand Teton Mountains, and they're called the Oh My God Mountains, because when you drive into the valley and you see these huge, towering mountains, all you can say is, oh my God, in a spirit of reverence. So the Grand Tetons is high among them. But I also have a special place for the Grand Canyon and the Everglades, which are in my backyard. So my absolute favorite, easy place to visit.
Did you used to go to the Everglades before you started this journey, or was it only after you discovered faraway national parks that you began to go to the ones that were close to home?
That's the funniest thing, Orly. I didn't even know about the Everglades until after we came back from around the country. So I went to the Everglades after we made that big loop around the country, and only because we were at a meeting of the Audubon Society, and a young woman came to talk to the group about Everglades restoration, and Frank and I looked at each other and said, well, we've got to go see the Everglades next, and then we fell madly in love.
It's amazing. Tell us about how the book is structured and how you hope it will help people to explore the parks.
Well, I wrote this book particularly for newcomers to the national park system in mind. So I tell people where the parks are, how to get there, where to stay, even when to go, and what parks are in close proximity, and you can do them in a weekend or in one, you know, discrete trip.
And what are some of the recommendations from the book that you would tell people for our listeners who might be thinking about taking a trip to a national park this summer or maybe even next summer and just don't feel like they're quite ready to take the plunge and buy those tickets or get in their car? You know, what tips would you give them?
Well, I would tell them that I discovered the national park system when I was in my 40s, and I now divide my life in terms of BP and AP, before parks and after parks, because once you know about the national parks, you can never stay home again. So I would encourage them, if they're even thinking about it, to go ahead and do it. Yes, start off with a road trip to a park in your area, because every state now has parks. Delaware was the last state to get a park, but now every state has a park, and there are parks that are within easy driving distance from every American. And the great thing to know is that if there's a passenger in the car who's over age 60, they can buy a national park's pass for $10 that allows them and every person in their car entrance to every national park and the system for the rest of their lives.
That's amazing.
So it's the most economical thing, yes. It's just a short drive away and a discovery and an awareness that you can never even imagine until you go.
What I love about the national park system is just the fact that we have decided as a nation to take the most beautiful places and to say, you know, we're not going to allow some billionaire to just build a mansion and own this vista for themselves. This land actually physically belongs to every taxpaying citizen of the United States. And that when you go to those parks, even if you don't own an expensive vacation home, you know that you actually own a piece of that land, of that, you know, glorious vista and amazing setting.
There is nothing that gives me greater pleasure than when I drive up to the entrance place at one of the parks that actually have an entrance fee, and hand my park's pass to the ranger. It makes me feel like I belong to the most select club on earth. Of course, everybody can have one. You know, mm-hmm. That's a great thing. Every American can have one of those national parks pass. It costs $80 if you're not yet 62, and it allows you to visit the park with your whole carload of people for a full year. But just knowing that I'm a card-carrying member of this entity that can have free access to all these amazing national parks that we have set aside makes me feel like a highly privileged person.
Well, I hope that many of our listeners will take inspiration from you and hit the road this summer and go explore some of our national parks. Where can they buy your book if they want to check it out?
preferably on my website, which is legacyontheland.com. That's the name of our other book, legacyontheland.com. Or I think it's also available on Amazon, Our True Nature, Finding a Zest for Life in the National Park System.
And for people who are interested in following your work and what you do, you also have a blog, isn't that correct?
Yes, yes, yes. And the blog is posted on that website as well. Click on Visiting National Parks.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I want to say that, yes, we are here to the most glorious legacy that a people have ever received. And I think it was President Theodore Roosevelt who said, it is going to be up to us to decide if we are worthy of it. And you won't know if you're worthy of it until you know these places and you really feel the burning desire in your heart to help maintain, help be stewards of them so that succeeding generations can benefit from them as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this inspiration with us. You've been listening to Audrey Peterman. She's the author of a book called Our True Nature, Finding a Zest for Life in the National Park System. Joining us now is Janet Larson, the Director of Research at the Earth Policy Institute and also the co-author of a new book called The Great Energy Transition. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start by talking a bit about how you came to write this book. I know that there were a number of authors that came together to work on it.
That's right. We've been working together at the Earth Policy Institute, and my colleagues Lester Brown, Matt Roney, and Emily Adams and I have been tracking a variety of social, economic, and environmental trends, trying to figure out, is the world moving in a sustainable direction, and if not, what we can do to change things around. And what we have been seeing as we looked globally is that there truly is an energy revolution underway. So we wrote The Great Transition to put together information about just how fast we're moving away from fossil fuels and shifting to solar and wind energy.
And your book details the tremendous range of developments that are part of this global transition away from fossil fuels towards clean energy. One of the things I think is most interesting is the plummeting cost of solar and wind power. Tell us a little bit more about that.
It's really amazing. Back in the 1970s, during the energy crises, the price of getting electricity from solar panels was about $74 per watt. Now it's less than 70 cents per watt, and most of this dramatic drop in prices of solar electricity has come in the last 5 years when panel prices fell by over 75%, which has really helped global installations grow annually now by more than 50% a year, which is incredibly rapid growth. So solar is being adopted everywhere from small villages in Bangladesh or sub-Saharan Africa to large installations either on rooftops or taking up fields by large global companies like Google or Apple. Wind costs are also falling pretty fast. Right now, you can sign a contract in the Midwestern United States for wind at about 25 cents per kilowatt hour, which compares nationwide to an average grid electricity price of about 10 to 12 cents per kilowatt hour. So wind truly is a bargain. The amazing thing about wind is that the fuel itself is free. So once you put up a wind farm, your wind turbines are harnessing electricity from nature that's inexhaustible and can last forever.
What were some of the things that most surprised you as you were researching this book?
Well, it's been amazing to watch the adoption of renewable energy. Many of us have heard about how fast European countries are moving into renewables. Just last year, Denmark got 43% of its electricity from wind. Portugal and Spain each got more than 20%, and Ireland got about 19%. And that's great for Europe. We know that they have stronger climate change goals and policies than we do in the United States, certainly. But even in the United States, we have 9 states now getting more than 10% of their electricity from the wind. Iowa and South Dakota now are getting more than 25% of their electricity from the wind. So it's proving that wind can be a major source of electricity. It's no longer marginal. In the big state of Texas, they're now getting close to 10% of their electricity from wind. And because the Texas market is so large, if Texas were a country, it would actually be number 6 in the world rankings for wind power, following China, the United States, Germany, Spain, and India. And just to mention about China, in China, wind power has overtaken nuclear power for electric generation. So the Chinese are even getting more of their power from wind turbines spinning in the breeze than from nuclear.
And of course, part of this is also that coal is on the decline as well. And I know the Sierra Club has really been leading the charge with the Beyond Coal campaign, which features in the book. Tell us a little bit more about that.
It's been really amazing to watch what's happened with coal. Right now, Wall Street will not touch anything that has to do with coal. In the Stowe Global Coal Index, which is a composite index of coal-related companies, has fallen 70% since 2011, while this S&P grew about 50%. So the writing is on the wall that coal's on the way out. And yes, Sierra has really been instrumental there. In fact, as we were undergoing revisions of our book, that was one number we kept having to cross out and update as new coal-fired power plant cancellations were getting announced. So as far as I know, the latest number I've seen is about 191 of the country's 523 coal-fired power plants have announced that they have closed or will be closing shortly. So, yeah, we're seeing a coal plant closure about every 10 days in the United States.
It's really amazing. Of course, also, oil is a big part of the challenge, the puzzle that we have to solve. So how quickly do you think the electric vehicle market will expand?
Electric vehicles are small now as a share of our total fleet, but I think they're growing incredibly quickly. In the Great Transition book, we cite a report by the global financial services firm UBS that looked at the market for Europe and found that by 2020, with battery costs falling by half, electric vehicles will be cost competitive with traditional cars. Now, since that report came out, just in the last few months, we've been seeing battery costs falling even faster than they had been projected. So within a matter of years, it will be cost competitive to buy an electric vehicle plus a rooftop solar system and battery storage. And you'll have a system that can basically pay for itself within a matter of 8 to 10 years, after which you'll be able to get electricity for charging your car and for your home essentially for free. So as the battery costs are falling, following in the footsteps of solar costs falling, I think we'll see very quick adoption.
What about the financial sector embracing renewables? You talked a little bit about Wall Street not wanting to touch coal, but what about the ways in which it's encouraging the adoption of cleaner technologies?
It's pretty amazing to watch how firms like Morgan Stanley or Goldman are putting tens of billions of dollars behind renewable energy. I think they're seeing it as a major growth market and realizing that we just can't count on fossil fuels forever. So while many of us in the environmental realm have been saying that for years, I think Wall Street is now catching on. And one group of people that we've looked at are the billionaires, the so-called smart money, and where that's going. And we see people like Ted Turner, for instance, teaming up with Southern Power, a utility serving 8 states from California to North Carolina, having acquired 7 solar plants with a combined 300 megawatts. Or Warren Buffett, as of last year, having invested $15 billion in renewable energy, saying there's another $15 billion ready to go. And these investments, they're making them, you know, not to save the planet or do environmental good, but really because they make business sense. Businesses themselves are not just investing in renewable energy, but actually putting installations on their own facilities to save costs. So Walmart, for instance, will be, over the next several years, adding PV systems on the roof of its U.S. buildings, aiming to get 400 more stores with solar power. And the former CEO, when he made this announcement, he said it's a business decision. The renewable energy we buy meets or beats prices from the grid. So we have Walmart, we have Apple making an $850 $850 million solar power purchase agreement with First Solar to supply its California operations, also investing in renewables to power its facilities in China. And Google provides us a nice example of looking at this energy transition underway because they turned an old oil and gas field into a solar power plant. So instead of having our old oil and gas derricks going up and down, we have the solar panels silently turning sunlight into electricity.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I think one thing that's incredibly exciting about this energy transition is it really provides a source of independence that we haven't known before. The old fossil fuel economy was largely geographically segmented. So oil, for instance, came in large quantities from very certain parts of the world. But solar and wind are widely distributed, easily available. It gives everyone a chance to have a hand in powering their old energy economy as opposed to the old one, which was really tightly controlled by those who were lucky enough to hold fossil fuel deposits. So this new energy economy is much more democratic.
This is WHFR Dearborn at 89.3, WHFR.FM, Making Waves. The Malt Shop is next. Right now, it's time for the WHFR Neighborhood News from Henry Ford College's TCM 261 Broadcast Journalism class.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the WHFR Neighborhood News. From HFC's Broadcast Journalism class, I'm DJ, along with
Deontay Hunter.
And now here's the news from your neighborhood. Amazon announced yesterday their plan to launch a technology hub in downtown Detroit, according to the Detroit Free Press. In addition to this news, Detroit is also buzzing with Amazon's donation of $10,000 in 30 Amazon Fire tablets to Carver STEM Academy program in Detroit Public Schools. Amazon's network will serve to build more full-time technology-driven jobs. The contribution to Detroit's growing tech presence is being welcomed with open arms, as Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan says. Having a global company establish a base in the city is another example of how more businesses are seeing Detroit as a good investment. To learn more about job opportunities with Amazon in Michigan, go to amazon.com/careers.
Motive is still unclear in the axe murder that took place Saturday in Wayne. The Detroit Free Press is reporting that Jesse Gunderson is facing first-degree murder charges in the death of his grandfather, Danny Dart. His grandparents took in Gunderson when he showed up without warning from California nearly a month ago, but around 5 p.m. Saturday, Gunderson murdered Dart with an axe in his backyard. Gunderson's arraignment was scheduled for 9 a.m. today.
A former area gymnastics instructor fled the state to avoid prosecution for 6 counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. According to the Detroit Free Press, it all started in July 2014 when East Lansing police investigated accusations that Michael Alexander Fruten, age 25, had sexual relations with a 14-year-old. Fruten was the alleged victim's instructor at Red Cedar Gymnastic in Dele Township, East Lansing. Fruten learned of the investigation and fled the state. East Lansing and Michigan State Police worked with federal officials to track him down. Fruten was arrested in Los Angeles on September 4th. A hearing to determine whether Fruten should stand trial is set for October 15th.
The city of Warren is facing a lawsuit of up to $5 million in damages, according to the Detroit Free Press. The suit has been filed by 23 state-approved medical marijuana users who say they've been harassed and ticketed by Warren police. Attorney Michael Greener claims that in addition to the harassment of the medical marijuana users, Warren zoning officials, Police Commissioner Jared Green, and Mayor Fouts cooperated to shut down the Michigan Safe Transfer Center, a center dedicated to the safe transfer of medical marijuana. Greener, who is a partner in the Michigan Safe Transfer, has reached out to the zoning department and the mayor, but the response has been unreceptive.
Officials say no one was injured in a house explosion that took place in Warren yesterday. The Detroit News reported that the house exploded around 1:30 Monday afternoon on Harold near Reuben, but was empty when it went up in flames. Fire Chief David Frederick was on the scene and said the cause of the explosion has not been determined, but officials are looking into a gas leak.
The nonprofit group Women Celebrating Life Downriver will be hosting an Oktoberfest in support of women diagnosed with breast cancer. The two decades old nonprofit was founded to offer support to men and women that were diagnosed with breast cancer. Support has come in the form of monetary stipends for their financial needs. This year's Oktoberfest will be modeled after festivals held in Munich, Germany, at 5:30 on September 13th. The food and drinks will be Germany-themed with beers, apples, strudels, and other delicacies. In addition, bartenders and owners of German-based companies will make an appearance as servers and entertainers, all who can be seen free of admission.
Now here's WHFR weather for Dearborn and vicinity. Cloudy skies with a chance of showers today, windy with a high of 74, chance of rain 70%. Rain ending later today, cloudy and a low of 54 degrees tonight. A few clouds but mostly sunny tomorrow and a high of 67. Clear skies and cooler for the rest of the week, highs in the low 60s, lows in the mid 40s. Right now, light rain and 7 degrees here at HFC.
That wraps up this edition of the WHFR Neighborhood News. I'm Deontay Hunter, along with
DJ.
Have a good afternoon, and thank you for listening to WHFR.FM, the station that's making waves.
Hey, boys and girls, if you like songs that go from this to something like this, then you should check out my show, Lights Out on WHFR Dearborn, hosted by yours truly, Mr. Camo. Playing the best in techno, trance, industrial, rave, drum and bass, breaks, and everything that involves electronic. So even though it's the middle of the day, we can still turn the lights out and have a party every Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m. on the only station making waves, WHFR Dearborn.
Okay, what are you wearing right now?
Nothing.
That's right. So mommy's going to teach you how to dress yourself. Underwear always comes first, name tag at the back, then pants, then shirt. Get the first button in the right hole or you have to start all over. Socks going first, then shoes, right on right, left on left. With shoelaces, just take the ends, cross them over, switch the loops, the rabbit goes down the hole, pull tight, and you're left with bunny ears. Got it? Why are your pants on your head?
Most parenting is hard to do in just 2 minutes. 2 minutes twice a day, making sure they brush their teeth, is easier, and it could help save them from a lifetime of tooth pain. Visit 2min2x.org to find out more. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ag Council.
Green jobs are here to stay. Why not go green with a degree in alternative energy here at Henry Ford College? Students will acquire knowledge in advanced fuel sources and the practice of alternative energy in the world. For more information on the Alternative Energy Program, please contact HFC's Technology Division by calling 313-317-9816 or by going to hfcc.edu/programs.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Hello, you guys and dolls out there. You're at the Malt Shop with Daddy G. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop. Where the jukebox is playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Shoot on, show me door, show me one, still.